This is Audible.
My name is Malidoma. It means roughly be friend with a stranger enemy. Because the Dagara believes that every individual comes into this life with a special destiny, some names are programmatic. They describe the task of their bearers and constitute a continual reminder to the child of the responsibilities that are waiting up ahead. A person's life project is therefore inscribed in the name he or she carries. As my name implies, I'm here in the West to tell the world about my people in any way I can, and to take back to my people the knowledge I gain about this world. My elders are convinced that the West is as endangered as the indigenous cultures it has decimated in the name of colonialism. There is no doubt that at this time in history, Western civilization is suffering from a great sickness of the soul. The West, progressive, turning away from functioning spiritual values, its total disregard for the environment and the protection of natural resources, the violence of inner cities with their problems of poverty, drugs and crime, spiraling unemployment and economic disarray, and growing intolerance toward people of color and the values of other cultures. All of these trends, if unchecked, will eventually bring about a terrible self-destruction. In the face of all this global chaos, the only possible hope is self-transformation. Unless we as individuals find new ways of understanding between people, ways that can touch and transform the heart and soul deeply, both indigenous cultures and those in the West will continue to fade away, dismayed at all the wonders of technologies, all the many philosophical isms, and all the planning of global corporation will be helpless to reverse this trend. I could not speak English when I arrived in the United States 10 years ago, even though I had taken some English classes at the Jesuit seminary in my teens. One of my greatest problems was that the things I talk about here did not happen in English. They happen in a language that has a very different mindset about reality. There is usually a significant violence done to anything being translated from one culture to another. Modern American English, which seems to be better suited for quick fixes and the thrill of a consumer culture, seems to falter when asked to communicate another person's worldview. From the time I began to jot down my first thoughts until the last word, I found myself on the bumpy road to mediumship, trying to ferry meanings from one language to another and from one reality to another, a process that denaturalizes and confuses them. I was born in the early 50s in Burkina Faso in West Africa, then called Upper Volta by the colonial French government who invaded my country in the early 1900s. Although my parents did not record my birth, and to this day are still in conflict as to the exact date, my papers say I was born in 1956. When I was 4 years old, my childhood and my parents were taken from me when I was literally kidnapped from my home by a French Jesuit missionary who had befriended my father. At that time, Jesuits were trying to create a native missionary force to convert a people who had wearied of their message along with their colonial oppression. For the next 15 years, I was in a boarding school, far away from my family, and forced to learn about the white man's reality, which included lessons in history, geography, anatomy, mathematics, and literature. All of these topics were presented with a good dose of Christianity and its temperamental God, who forced everyone to live in constant fear of his wrath. At the age of 20, I escaped and went back to my people, but found that I no longer fit into the tribal community. I risked my life to undergo the Dagara initiation and thereby return to my people. During that month-long ritual, I was integrated back into my own reality as well as that could be. But I never lost my Western education. So I am a man of two worlds, trying to be at home in both of them. A difficult task at best. When I was 22, my elders came to me and asked me to return to the white man's world to share with him what I had learned about my own spiritual tradition through my initiation. For me, initiation had eliminated my confusion, helplessness, and pain, and opened the door to a powerful understanding of the link between my own life purpose and the will of my ancestors. I had come to understand the sacred relationship between children and old people, between fathers and their adolescent sons, between mothers and daughters. I knew especially why my people have such a deep respect for old age, and why a strong, functioning community is essential for the maintenance of an individual's sense of identity, meaning, and purpose. I use this knowledge as my starting point. My own elders had experienced French colonialism and the culture of the West as a force that used violence as a means to eradicate traditional life ways. They had seen their own youth stolen from them as they vainly struggled against the incursion of these intruders. During these years in which my people were trying to make sense of a people whose every action seemed to go against the natural order of things, creating chaos, death, and destruction, the sense of unified community that sustained their tribal life was profoundly destabilized. These foreigners seemed to have no respect for life, tradition, or the land itself. At first, my elders refused to believe that a race of people who could cause such suffering and death could possibly have any respect for itself. It did not take long before they realized that the white man wanted nothing short of the complete destruction of their culture and even their lives. For some of my people, befriending the white man was the best way they could find to fight back. By doing this, they hoped to get to know how the white man's mind worked and what they thought they were accomplishing by invading another people's ancestral lands. Not all of my people were willing to have this much contact with the whites. Some village people who chose to see things only from their own tribal perspective believed that to have become so spiritually sick, the white man must have done something terrible to his own ancestors. Others who knew a little about military culture, imperialism, and colonialism thought that the white man must have destroyed his own land to have to come here and take the land of others. In spite of the best efforts of all my people, the white kept on coming, kept on doing whatever they pleased, and kept on taking more and more of our land, our beliefs, and our lives. Many years later, my generation finds itself gripped by a powerful irony. Suddenly, it has become popular to defend tribal people, their worldview, and their life ways. But while the West is engaged in a great debate about what it means to preserve culture, the indigenous world is aware that it has already lost the battle. It seems obvious to me that as soon as one culture begins to talk about preservation, it means that it has already turned the other culture into an endangered species. Then you have the purists on either side who want indigenous culture to remain exactly the same as they have always been. In many cultures, the Dagara included, it is no longer a question of preservation, but of survival in some form or another. the culture's own reality has already been superseded by the fashionable modernity. I see my position as a two-way passage of information, as both a bridge and a conduit. By agreeing to move between both worlds, I seek to bring about some kind of balance. I deeply respect the story I've told in this book. I respect it because it embodies everything that is truly me, my ancestors, my tribe, my life. It is a very complicated story whose telling caused me great pain, but I had to tell it. Only in this way could I ultimately fulfill my purpose to befriend the stranger enemy. My first assignment after my initiation into the tribe was to seek entrance into the university. I did so equipped with the special knowledge that initiation had provided me with. I had one thing in my pocket, a little talisman. This talisman was an oval-shaped pouch stuffed with a stone from the underworld and some other secret object collected in the wild. Though it is common to carry a talisman in my village, for they are a great source of power and protection, people fear them. Every Dagara knows that powerful objects are dangerous. Depending on the action of its bearer, such objects have the power to help, but also to hurt. Therefore, talismans are treated with great respect and care. My pouch was sewn tightly shut and then decorated with a way that enhanced its ugliness and scariness. These objects are always made to look ugly and fearsome, perhaps to stress their supernatural quality. Besides, my experience of the other world has led me to understand that anything that crosses from that place into this one is seldom beautiful, as if anything spiritually potent must look ugly and smell bad in order to work. My talisman certainly did. At one end of the oval pouch was a tuft of strange animal hair. The government of what was then called Upper Volta had a school called the Centre d'Etudes Supérieures, whose course of study was the equivalent of a 4-year college in the West. It had been built several years earlier by the now departed French colonials as part of the incentive to the newly independent countries of Africa. The end of territorial colonialism was followed by a period of neo-colonialism that took the form of bilateral cooperation, economic sponsorship, and professional support in every pertinent department of the new government. And so the college was one of the many faces of this new colonialism, whose goal is to place the newly independent countries into a state of perpetual indebtedness. It is important to understand that modern Africa does not exist as it is by the will of its leaders, but by the will of the very powers that divided it between them. Every student in the center was there on scholarship, and every year there was a huge number of candidates who applied for the few scholarships available. Those who obtained them were usually students whose parents were either well-to-do or could pull some strings. The politician would simply order the scholarship board to grant the awards to their relatives or children. Wealthy people who lacked political power bribed their way to scholarship for their loved one, but even the wealthy did not always succeed. For after the political scholarship were granted, there were few left for the bulk of the candidates. The year that I applied was no different from any other. I had failed in my application for a scholarship knowing that I had no chance of getting beyond the filing. Yet I felt it was still worth a try. What did I have to lose? To my great surprise, I was scheduled for an interview and was not only informed of my acceptance to the school, but given a full scholarship on the spot. I cannot tell you the detail of how my talisman worked, for I prefer not to blunt its effectiveness, but it is still helping me today to speak in big assembly hall. Though invitations come in unorthodox ways, I always seem to be able to get where I need to go and to say what I need to say. I spent 4 years in that Center for Higher Education, which later became the National University. I walked away from it with a bachelor's degree in sociology, literature, and linguistics, and a master's thesis in world literature. Our only reason for being there was our need to transcend the alarming social and economic situation in which most of us were caught. We did not need to be told that a proper Western education were the key to good Western job and a decent life. For most people, top performance in that school meant hard work. As an initiated man, I did not have to work hard to get my degrees. I skipped a great deal of these classes, made sure that I was present at the exams, and walked away with my diplomas. The answers to the exam question were mostly visible in the aura of the teachers who constantly patrolled the aisles of their testing rooms. I just had to write these answers down quickly before any one of them noticed how strangely I was looking at him or her. During my second year in college, the teacher began to notice me. It was harder and harder for me to cut classes. When I was picked by the professor to reply to a question, I continued to instinctively seek the answers in his aura, as I did during exams. To me, it was like being asked to read out of an open book. This method worked so well that one day one of my teachers looked at me suspiciously and asked, "Have you been reading my mind?" Of course, I said no. We were in the modern world where such things are impossible. My talisman continued to work for me. I was awarded a scholarship to the Sorbonne, where I received a DEA, a Diplôme d'études approfondies in political science. Later, I continued my education at Brandeis University, earning a PhD in literature. I'm not writing about all these accomplishments to impress you, but to show you that what I have learned as an initiated man really worked, at least for me, in Western reality. I came to the United States shortly after my mentor announced it in the course of one of my numerous divination sessions during my first trip to the village. He said I was going to cross the big sea into a land where I will be able to do what I must. A scholarship brought me here. That's the way most black Africans enter into the heart of the civilized world. During my time in the West, I have found myself facing an interesting paradox. People approach me not because I am an educated man, but because the tribal outfit I wear seems to have an effect on them. It initiates contact. Conversations always seem to begin with someone saying, "Nice outfit. Where do you come from?" I answer by saying, "Burkina Faso." The response is invariably, "What? Well, where is that?" Sometimes I feel like a walking billboard, but these conversations always give me food for thought. I learn to understand my own culture better by comparing it with others. Ironically, I'm more free to be African in the West than I am in Africa. In my country, a man with as many degrees as I have wears a Western suit and tries to act cosmopolitan. He does not want to be reminded of where he comes from or what he has left behind. He has turned his back on superstition and embraced progress. Here in the West, I have a great deal of time for spiritual contemplation and study, and much more time to share things of the spirit with others. If I were still living in my village in Africa, nearly every spare moment would be taken up with scratching a living from the exhausted soil that is all colonialism has left us with. The $600 American I send every year to my family feeds them and many others for a year. Although I miss them and would prefer to see them more often, I know I'm taking better care of them here than I could by going home and picking up a hoe, even if the elders had left that option open to me. Living in this culture and being openly African also has its moments of comedy and suspense. For example, when I travel to conferences, I always take my medicine bag with me. I've always been afraid to check it in the baggage for fear that it will somehow be lost, a terrible thought to contemplate, since without it and the magical objects it contains, I would not be able to do the many hundreds of divinations I perform for people each year. The first time I carried my medicine bag through the airport, I realized when I arrived at the x-ray machine that I could not have my medicine x-rayed. I did not want my medicine to be seen. I realized that if I did, I would have to explain its strange contents to the guards. This would be awkward, to say the least. Besides, I was not altogether sure what this modern technological contraption would do to my medicine. The guard asked me if I had filmed in the bag. I said no, but I had something just as sensitive. That did it. Bristling with suspicion, the security officer poured the contents of the bag out onto the table. I saw his eyes open wide as he asked, "What the hell is this?" Other officers joined him, and they all looked in surprise at the content of our medicine bag. One of them, a black officer, said, "That's voodoo stuff," and ordered them to put it through the x-ray machine while he held a talisman in his hand and looked at it with great suspicion. I stood there wishing I could have checked my pouch in the baggage to avoid this embarrassment, but I realized I could not part with my medicine. By this time, a small crowd had gathered. My heart was beating rapidly. My medicine had become public. I quickly put it all back into the bag and put the bag on the x-ray conveyor belt. My talisman came on screen. The officers stopped the belt, stared at them intensely for an infinite amount of time, then reactivated the belt. I picked my bag up with relief at the other end. From that day on, I began to think about new ways to avoid these embarrassing moments. Every day we get closer to living in a global community. With distances between countries narrowing, we have much wisdom to gain by learning to understand other people's culture and permitting ourselves to accept that there is more than one version of reality. To exist in the first place, each culture has to have its own version of what is real. What I am attempting to share with you in this book is only one of the endless versions of reality. In the culture of my people, the Dagara, we have no word for the supernatural. The closest we come to this concept is Yelbongura, the thing that knowledge can't eat. This word suggests that the life and power of certain things depend upon the resistance to the kind of categorizing knowledge that human beings apply to everything. In Western reality, there is a clear split between the spiritual and the material, between religious life and secular life. This concept is alien to the Dagara. For us, as for many indigenous cultures, the supernatural is part of our everyday life. To a Dagara man or woman, the material is just the spiritual taking on form. The secular is religion in a lower key, a rest area from the tension of religious and spiritual practice. Dwelling in the realm of the sacred is both exciting and terrifying. A little time out once in a while is in order. The world of the Dagara also does not distinguish between reality and imagination. To us, there is a close connection between thought and reality. To imagine something, to closely focus one's thought upon it, has the potential to bring that something into being. Thus, people who take a tragic view of life and are always expecting the worst usually manifest that reality. Those who expect that things will work together for the good usually experience just that. In the realm of the sacred, this concept is taken even further. For what is magic, but their ability to focus thought and energy to get results on the human plane. The Daguerreau view of reality is large. If one can imagine something, then it has at least the potential to exist. I decided to do a little experiment of my own with reality versus imagination when I was home visiting my village in 1986. I brought with me a little electronic generator, a television monitor, a VCR, and a Star Trek tape entitled The Voyage Home. I wanted to know if the Daguerreau elder could tell the difference between fiction and reality. The event unfolding in a science fiction film considered futuristic or fantastic in the West were perceived by my elders as the current affairs in the day-to-day lives of some other group of people living in the world. The elders did not understand what a starship is. They did not understand what the fussy uniform of its crew members had to do with making magic. They recognized in Spock a contumely of the seventh planet, the very one that I described later in this story, and their only objection to him was that he was too tall. They had never seen a contumely that big. They had no problem understanding light speed and teleportation, except that they could have done it more discreetly. I could not make them understand that all this was not real. Even though stories abound in my culture, we have no word for fiction. The only way I could get across to them the Western concept of fiction was to associate fiction with telling lies. My elders were comfortable with Star Trek, the West's vision of its own future, because they believe in things like magical being, Spock, for instance, traveling at the speed of light, and teleportation, the wonders that Westerners imagine being part of their future, are very much a part of my elders' present. The irony is that the West sees the indigenous world as primitive or archaic. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the West could learn to be as archaic as my elders are? As in the case of Star Trek, Westerners look to the future as a place of hope, a better world where every person has dignity and value, where wealth is not unequally distributed, where the wonders of technology make miracles possible. If people in the West could embrace some of the more positive values of the indigenous world, perhaps that might even provide them with a shortcut to their own future. Many people in the West seem to be trying to find this shortcut through their commitment to learning about indigenous cultures, non-Western forms of spirituality, or, most recently, through the men's movement. If the seekers fail, and if the modern world lets the indigenous world die, it would probably mean a long, hard trip into the future in search of the values of the past. Westerners forget that it is not only indigenous culture that have a deep commitment to non-Western ideas about reality. Even in a highly industrialized culture like Japan, a connection with the ancestors is taken very seriously. When the new emperor of Japan was installed, many leaders in the West were disturbed by the fact that as part of his inauguration, he went into the temple and spoke to his ancestors. Why is it that the modern world can't deal with its ancestors and endure its past? It is my belief that the present state of restlessness that traps the modern individual has its roots in a dysfunctional relationship with the ancestor. In many non-Western cultures, the ancestors have an intimate and absolutely vital connection with the world of the living. They are always available to guide, to teach, and to nurture. They represent one of the pathways between the knowledge of this world and the next. Most importantly, and paradoxically, of course, they embody the guidelines for successful living, all that is most valuable about life. Unless the relationship between the living and the dead is in balance, chaos results. When a person from my culture looks at the descendants of the Westerners who invaded their culture, they see a people who are ashamed of their ancestors because they were killers and marauders masquerading as artisans of progress. The fact that these people have a sick culture comes as no surprise to them. The Dagara believes that if such an imbalance exists, it is the duty of the living to heal their ancestors. If these ancestors are not healed, their sick energy will haunt the soul and psyches of those who are responsible for helping them. Not all people in the West have such an unhealthy relationship with their ancestors, but for those who do, the Dagara can offer a model for healing the ancestors and, by doing so, healing oneself. Because the world is becoming smaller, people from different realities can benefit from learning about and accepting each other. The challenge of modernity is to bring the world together into a unified whole in the middle of which diversity can exist. The respect for difference works only if connected with this vision. The first time I presented the material contained in this book was at a multicultural men's conference in Virginia. I needed to discover what, in the sequence of initiation experiences, could be put into words, and then see how this information would be received by the audience. I had heard other people tell the story of their initiation, but this story sounded greatly different from mine. Some of the story I'd heard seemed to make the process a mild formality, deliberately safe to the point where everyone was guaranteed to come out fine. In the Dagara culture, initiation is a dangerous commitment that can, and sometimes does, result in death. And I did not want to upset people who might be thinking of it differently. Was I not supposed to make friends with a stranger? I did not want to make initiation sound and reachable either. My wish was to strike some kind of balance between the modern person's mind and his heart by communicating to both of them. Within this group of men of opposing color and culture who had gathered together to figure out how to bridge gap and reach out to each other, the initial atmosphere was one closer to war than to peace. On the day of my presentation, the room was jam-packed with busy professional men who had cleared a whole week off their schedule to come to this conference. Their expectations were high. As I began telling my story, I could hear the sound of my own voice competing with the pounding of my heart and the terrible sound of the audience's silence. Images of my initiation rushed into my mind as if someone stood behind me and passing them to me on picture postcards. I merely took them and passed them on. Soon I forgot my heartbeat, then the crowd, then myself. When I finished, something happened that I had never expected, something I was not prepared to handle. 120 men gave me a standing ovation, men of European, African, Oriental, Indian, Native American descent. The intensity of their response filled every corner of my mind, body, and heart, and threatened to draw a tear out of me. I fought hard to keep from weeping while the clapping seemed to go on for an eternity. I do not remember how I recovered from this response. The whole time, all I could do was to wonder what could be the explanation for this kind of overwhelming response. What was it in those men that understood what I had said about initiation so fully that they responded to it as if it were something familiar to them? They were not simple men. On the contrary, they were sophisticated, highly educated individuals, psychologists, therapists, anthropologists, men versed in myth, medical doctors, sociologists, lawyers, and who knows what else. and they all had the same response. It took me a week and more to recover from the telling of my story. People came to me afterward to ask if I had written it down so they could have it. I had long had a question as to whether I could tell the intellible. I now had my answer. Some parts, at least, could be told. And so I knew where to start. Since then, I have told the story of my initiation many times. The response has invariably been the same, and this response has given me the courage to share more information about elders, youth, medicine, healing, and the indigenous world of the Dagara, which my own initiation had allowed me to access. My grandfather's funeral ritual described in this book was one of those realities. I presented it once at a conference, leaving out many of the elaborate magical details. I was hardly surprised to find that it too had the power to touch people in this culture. I have since, and with great support, conducted a form of the Dagara funeral rituals with Americans as participants. Watching people of this culture devote themselves to a funeral ritual the Dagara way was as baffling to me as my initiation story must have been to them. I was glad the elders from my village weren't present. They would have thought I had made it up. But something in it, maybe the sincerity of over 100 men mourning their losses, broke my heart. It is in response to them and to others who desired to know more that I have gathered the energy to write this book. It is also for every old person in this culture who feels abandoned as if he or she has become useless, and for the young ones in search of a purpose and a blessing from some sacred old hand that I write. These two groups of people need to get their relationships straight. Maybe they will discover each other through this book. Their unspoken support had given me the courage to speak out clearly and explicitly. It is time for Africans to clear their throats and enter boldly into the concert of spiritual and magical exchange. Books on other indigenous realities written by native people can be found everywhere. Those that deal with the deep tribal socio-spirituality of Africans are still the exclusive department of specialist foreign anthropologists or native anthropologists who have been foreignized, ethnographers and sociologists. This is the direct result of 500 years of European looting of the African continent. Being a man of two worlds is not easy. I have to constantly fight against the depressing energy of exile and homelessness. My degrees did not help resolve the problem of exile. They enforced it. The best degree I hold is the one that my elders have given me. It does not have a paper attached to it. It is ingrained in me, and it too is responsible for my feeling of exile. I have to watch where I go and what I do because of this sense of exile. Every year I have to return home to my elders, not to visit them, but to be cleansed. After several years of doing that, I have come to understand that being in the West is like being caught in a highly radioactive environment. Without this periodic checkup, I will lose my ability to function. Speaking with people in this culture, I also have come to understand that a lot of them born and raised in the West share this sense of exile, and that I may be better off than they are because I still have elders that I can go to who will make me feel at home for a while as they cleanse me. Sometimes I find myself wondering, however, how long can this last? Alienation is one of the many faces of modernity. The cure is communication and community, a new sense of togetherness. By opening to each other, we diminish the pressure of being alone and exile. I've told my story here with a wish that it will be of help to those who pick it up with a sense of hope, searching for answers of their own. In the village where I come from, there is something extremely important in the dynamics of people's lives. And one of the most obvious ones is the kind of relationships that exist between people. Namely, in this case, the relationship between the very old and the very young. Grandparents are very intimately linked to grandchildren because they constitute the two polar areas of support of the village dynamics. They say that the very old share with the very young the proximity with the world of the ancestors. And so as a result, when a baby is born, the first few years of that baby's life are spent next to the grandparent. Prior to that birth, and usually as early as 2.5 months into pregnancy, the mother to be is put through a ritual process which consists in asking or using the body of the mother to reach the soul that is in formation to arrive into this world in order to find out what the identity of that soul is and what its purpose on this journey on earth is supposed to be. We call that ritual an inquiry ritual. A few elders gathered around and they put the pregnant mother into some kind of trance state. And while she is in that mode, her voice shifts into becoming very thin and extremely fast moving. They call that the voice of the soul of the baby. The reason why they ask all these questions is because they see that the life that this incoming person is going to live is a missionary life. Again, this is directly linked to a village perception that no one comes into this world for no reason. And also because they believe that no one occurs here on vacation, as if the world is not a resort place. It's a place where people come to move their own souls further ahead in the grand journey scheme. And so, in order to help incoming people or incoming soul into this world so that they can do the very thing that they had meant to do upon arriving here, the living must first know what it is they want to do and who they are. And this is why this ritual inquiry is extremely important for elders in the village to determine the exact identity of any person who is taking on a human form. When all pieces of information are gathered, the birth of the baby, which happened much later on, is an opportunity for a name encapsulating all these information to be given to the baby on the third day following the birth, so that that name become, therefore, a constant reminder of the sort of thing that that person promised to do on this earth. We call that usually the kind of gift that the person is supposed to deliver to the village for the greatest good of the community. This is why my name, Malidoma, which means be friends with a stranger or the enemy, is very significant. because it is indeed the life path that I told my grandfather before even being born. One of the key influences in my life was my grandfather. He was one of the leading healers in the Dagara tribe, and especially a key magician and healer in the village of Dano, which is the village of my birth. My memories are still strong of these days when there were countless number of people gathered at the house, each one of them coming with a particular problem that they entrusted my grandfather for its resolution. I still remember these days when he used to carry me on his back while cooking all kinds of herbs. And I do remember that one of those herbs exhaled on my face led to my eyes cracking open into other layers of realities that were extremely perturbing to me, but overall became extremely useful in maintaining my connection with the spirit of my grandfather while I was caught up in this boarding school called seminary later on after his death. I also remember those moments when, sitting on his lap, I could listen to him talk to me as if I was an adult person, as if I was his equal. And indeed, throughout that time, he was always referring to me as a brother. Later on, I understood that in the village, grandfathers and grandsons have a brotherhood relationship between them, just as grandmothers and granddaughters have the same kind of relationship of sisterhood. They call each other sisters. I do also remember the fact that he was basically a powerful magician who was constantly dealing with the other world. And of course, because other worlds were so much intertwined with the world of the village, the world of the tribe, the mind of a 5-year-old boy could not distinguish between the two. I thought that these wonderful things were actually part and parcel of what reality is. And I do remember this very strong looking pot that was full of water and into which my grandfather would spend a whole night long looking until I found out that when he would look into that place, actually he had a picture of the family farm, which was about 8 miles away, and he was checking for wild animal invasions on the crop. I still remember seeing him take an arrow, which I later understood as a magical weapon, put it on the bow upside down and shoot it through a very thin hole on the ceiling of his room. And the next morning, my father dragged a huge animal. I still don't remember what the name of that animal is, but that arrow had gone out, traveled 8 miles, gone right through the body of that animal, and then come back to him. Later on, I found out that this is part of the magic of the particular ethnic group that my grandfather was in, and it was called the Pintul, meaning the upside-down arrow. It was used in the course of the raids against British invasion and French invasions, but later on was reduced to a simple magical medicine that was kept by the members of the ethnic community until recently, when its power began to fade away without no one knowing exactly what the reasons are. Some of my most striking experiences that had any form of consequences on my life later on, especially that life that was lived in the white man's school, were systematically brainwashed into perceiving the world from an angle that was totally contradictory. Some of those powerful experiences included what happened when my grandfather passed away. I do remember again that day when I woke up in the morning and everybody else has gone to the farm, and I realized that the door to the room where my grandfather was supposed to be was still closed. And when I called in for him and his faint voice responded, I knew that something was going wrong. I remember sitting next to him and he began to speak to me again as usual, as if I was an adult and an equal to him. And the images that were coming through were extremely fantastic. They included such thing as birds, the symbolism of bird swallowing people, flying up high, me with, coming back down on the ground, and all these people coming out. It took me 20 years to find out that he meant planes that I was going to be traveling in. I remember his talking about my being swallowed into a world, but to remember that that experience was part of my life purpose. And I also remember his telling me over and over that he will always be beside me to comfort me in times of insecurity, uncertainties, and difficulties. Because, as he said, we are brothers. The most important thing that I always keep in mind whenever I speak about my grandfather was indeed his funeral. One thing I should say about Dagara grief rituals here is that it is one of the most powerful village community's attention to a deceased. Every time someone dies in the village, everything stops. People's jobs are suspended. People's activities are suddenly redirected from what it was to the funeral that has been commanded by the sudden death of someone. What happened is that from then on, everybody is expected to enter into a grief mode, because it is believed that in order for the soul of the deceased to reach the land of the ancestors, that soul need to bathe in the tears of the people of the village. And therefore, everybody is expected to contribute some grief, including tears, in order to allow the soul of the deceased to swim across to the land of the ancestors. This whole process takes about 3 days and 3 nights. But eventually, it leaves everybody feeling more united than ever, as if grief is understood in the tribe as a linking agent, something that brings people together, something that unites them together. This is one of the very few things that have survived the onslaught of colonialism or neo-colonialism. When my grandfather died, as a result of his having been a great chief, his funeral not only included this constant wailing and grieving, but also it included the display of all the magical things that used to be associated with him during his lifetime. The funeral key part was basically the show of grandfather's connection with layers and layers of realities. And one of the fascinating part of that display was indeed the show of this pintul, which I mentioned earlier, this upside down arrow, which was shot through the same hole from which he used to do it, and which took flight in a manner that was so fascinating, because the arrow, when it came out, looked more like a shooting star and traveled at a very fast pace from one horizon to another, then came and circled around the ritual space where the funeral was happening, then came right down into the ground, missing a woman who was sitting there by a few inches, then rose up again from another place in the ground and went slowly this time back to the headquarters, as if someone from inside had ordered it to return. Even in the course of 15 years in the seminary, they hadn't done it at all. And therefore, it was the last time and the first time I ever seen it do the kind of thing that it did. One other thing was the appearance from out of the blue of this being that we refer to as Contumbly, which came to greet my grandfather or to say goodbye to his soul. I should say something about Contumblies, because they are the kind of being which you will see in certain Western mythologies. They are referred to, for instance, in Ireland as leprechauns. These beings are very well known throughout the Dagara tribe, and they are said to be the ones that provided Dagara people with all the magical knowledge they have. They came because, of course, grandfather had been interacting with them all his life. I still remember my mother carrying me on her back, going to the bush to fetch dry wood. And upon arriving at the wood place, freeing me up to run around. And as I was running around, I encountered a little rabbit that excited all my nerves. And I wanted to catch that rabbit at all costs. I remember running after this rabbit who entered into a little bush. And of course, I knew that in that bush there was no escape possible for the rabbit. So I was ready to make one of the fantastic catch, probably the first catch of my life. And so as I was about to land on the miserable rabbit, I realized that I was almost going to land on a tiny little, very old-looking man who was sitting on a circle of light, something that looked like a rainbow, but which was a circular seat, at the same time a window opened into a huge world behind him, and he was sitting there looking at me. Of course, became paralyzed all of a sudden, because that was the last thing I was expecting. What happened is that the elder, or miniature elder, if I may use that term, says something like, "Why you want to hurt your brother? He too has the mother. So what would his mother think if you hurt him?" Of course, in front of that, there was little I could say. My whole body was vibrating. The whole experience took what I now sense as just 1 minute. But the last word he said was that, "You got to go back to your mother. She's looking for you." At that time, I realized that in fact it was close to getting dark. And there had been hours and hours in the course of which my mother was looking for me. And yet,